Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Drop
what you're doing. I would vastly prefer to remember Dave Bing as the NBA Hall of Famer than as the mayor of Detroit, and chances are that Mr. Bing is looking back with fondness and no little nostalgia to his days as a deft shooting, if I'm not mistaken, shooting guard for the Pistons. Somebody's probably going to correct me on that. I think he was a shooting guard. But he was somebody who kept his head and was very rational. He was one of these players who was very methodical in terms of the way that he would pursue court strategy. And he was not particularly hung up on statistics, as I recall. I think a really good, albeit imperfect, more contemporary analog to his style of play would be that of John Stockton. John Stockton kept his head, but he was a fierce competitor. And he wasn't particularly hung up on accolades and statistics, but pound for pound, he's probably the toughest player in the history of the NBA. Now, Dave Bing was more elegant as a basketball player. For whatever reason, he went into private business after he retired from the NBA and was quite successful as a private businessman, but then he went into politics, and it was out of a sense, I guess, of what we now call public service, or at least an aspiration to serve the town that he loved, that he decided to offer himself as a gift to the voters of Detroit, and he was elected mayor. From what I understand, he is hard-nosed and principled. I probably don't share most of his politics, but I do respect people who do things well, and he certainly fits in that category. He just recently did something that was badly overdue, and that was fire the megalomaniacal dingbat who was the chief of police. This is from this morning's Wall Street Journal. Mayor Dave Bing fired the city's embattled police chief on Wednesday, hours before a local television station was to air a report on a reality show starring the commander. The move came after it became known that Police Chief Warren Evans appeared in a six-minute trailer for a reality television show called The Chief. Let me interject here. Reality television is an oxymoron. This is something that I wrote about, not merely that principle, but also some of the specifics of this story, in a piece that was published way back in May, entitled The Death of Iana Jones, Showtime Syndrome Claims a Child. You can find that either in, I believe, the May 17th or May 18th edition of Pro Libertate, the blog, or you can go to lewrockwell.com and simply insert in the search engine Iana Jones. That name is spelled A-I-Y-A-N-A Jones, Iana Jones. And I talked about the fact that in physics there is something called the observer effect, and that refers to an observable phenomena, if you will. The act of observing a reaction or a process can influence the process in question. If you're using certain instruments in order to take measurements or to document a process, the act of observing it can change what's going on. You insert a television camera or a microphone into a common human interaction and let people know that they are being recorded or what they are doing is being broadcasted, people irresistibly will pose and preen, as I'm doing right now, obviously. They will try to present themselves in the most flattering light. It changes the nature of what is happening. So there's, if you will, sort of a broad parallel we could draw here between this principle of physics and what you would call the observer effect in so-called reality television. If you want a really good example of that psychology at work, go to any urban setting where there is a large mirrored surface, say a hotel lobby or some of the more upscale retail stores. If you go to major cities such as New York or Boston or Chicago, you'll find this type of artifact. And if it's placed in a certain way where people will find themselves reflected in it, they can't resist the impulse to pose, to strike a pose in vogue, if you will. That's just the way we're wired. That's the way we're designed. I can't explain it. I really can't even control it in my case, but I can describe it to you. So when you're creating a so-called reality show, what's going to happen? People are going to try to present themselves and the institution that they represent in the best possible light for public consumption. And that changes the nature of whatever it is you're doing. Now, in the case of Iana Jones, you had this horrible episode from last spring in which a SWAT team raided a home after midnight, a residential home where there was a murder suspect, and they could have taken him into custody very easily in a very low-key manner. All they had to do was surround the house and wait, because eventually he was going to come out of the house. And as soon as he was out of the house, as soon as he was clear, they could have swooped in and taken him into custody with a minimal exertion of force and without the potential for lethal violence. Well, unfortunately, a SWAT team, despite the fact that they were in a residential neighborhood, B, they were in an area where they were targeting a home, a duplex, where the murder suspect was located on the second floor in a separate unit of the duplex, not in the duplex where Iana Jones was sleeping on the couch. C, they were targeting a residential home that was surrounded by children's toys, which even police officers should recognize is a clue that there are children in the immediate vicinity. And D, they were in circumstances in which everybody in the neighborhood had warned them that there were children inside that building. In spite of all of this, the SWAT team conducted a full-force raid involving the use of a concussion device called a flashbang grenade, which was thrown into the house at some point. We're not sure when, because according to the official account, the grenade went in first, then the SWAT team inserted itself forcefully into the home. At some point, the lead officer had what was called a tussle with the 47 or 48-year-old grandmother of Iana Jones, and according to the initial report, at this point, his handgun simply discharged itself, because that's the sort of thing handguns do all the time. They discharge themselves sua sponte, and as a result, Iana Jones, who had been sleeping on the couch, was shot through the head and killed. That's the official account. At least that was the first official account. That was revised after the fact because the grandmother was not taken into custody. Well, she was taken into custody but not detained and charged with resisting arrest or obstructing a police officer. It turned out that apparently the shots were fired into the house before the concussion grenade was launched, or before an announcement was made that a raid was underway. In any case, Iana Jones was shot through the head and killed, needlessly. Now, why did they go for a full-force raid in those circumstances? I contend it was because they had a camera crew along from an A&E program devoted to chronicling SWAT teams nationwide. Detroit SWAT was one variation on this format. You had Dallas SWAT. I believe they've chronicled the exploits of SWAT teams from some of the other major cities. Detroit SWAT is one of the elements of that rotation. And so they had a camera crew along, and I contend that that changed the nature of what happened. They chose a full-force raid because it made for better television than simply doing the plodding, somewhat phlegmatic work of simply waiting out that murder suspect and arresting him in a way that involved minimal imposition on the neighborhood. Well, that is the sort of culture, corporate culture, if you will, that comes down from the top, because Warren Evans, at this time, had been circulating what was called a sizzle reel. What is a sizzle reel? You don't sell the steak, you sell the sizzle. And so what this was could best be described as bait for television programmers. They were trying to build up interest in a reality show, quote-unquote reality show, featuring Warren Evans. Well, this six-minute sizzle reel was about to be released on Wednesday. At this point, Mayor Bing pulled the trigger and fired Warren Evans. Warren Evans should have been fired no later than last May, when it was revealed that that sizzle reel existed and that he had basically turned his police department into an engine of self-promotion. The reality show trailer, continues the Wall Street Journal, which was aired by Detroit TV station WXYZ shows Mr. Evans confronting criminal suspects and wearing heavy police gear. At one point, he says, "It is my job to keep the city safe. I'll do whatever it takes." As a matter of fact, when he's saying that, he's holding an automatic weapon, you know, an assault rifle, to use the common vernacular, standing in front of the old train station in Detroit, his chin outward thrust in what he no doubt considered to be a pose of Churchillian resolution. Basically, he was in the theater of his mind thinking, I wonder who they're going to get to play me in the movie. You know, are they going to get Morgan Freeman, perhaps? Anyhow, I'll have more about this on the other side of the break. This is Will Gregg, Pro Libertate Radio. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number here on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397. And we'll be back at you in just a minute or two. So Mayor Dave Bing of Detroit has fired former police chief Warren Evans, or as I've started to refer to him, Big Chief Sizzle Reel, under very bad circumstances, but amid some circumspection as to the specific cause for that decision. Mr. Bing, reported the Wall Street Journal this morning, wouldn't specify why he replaced Mr. Evans after barely a year on the job, but he made the decision Wednesday after concluding that some of his decisions, I think, compromised his position as chief. Ralph Godby, formerly the assistant police chief, will take over as interim chief. There are certain events that happened, certain decisions made over a period of time that led us to this decision, Mr. Bing said at a hastily called news conference in Detroit. Once again, it seems clear to me that the reason why Mr. Evans was fired was because a couple of local television stations were about to take public this so-called sizzle reel, this six-minute trailer for a proposed reality television program called The Chief that would have featured Warren Evans. And that, I think, is symptomatic of the mindset of this police department, like so many others across the country. I call this the Showtime Syndrome. Some of you have seen that film starring Eddie Murphy and, if I remember correctly, Robert De Niro. Eddie Murphy and Robert De Niro. I haven't seen it. I've seen clips from it. Robert De Niro is a straight-laced cop. Eddie Murphy is his wacky partner who wants to be a reality television star. And in the course of setting up this so-called reality television program with, I believe, Rene Russo from the Lethal Weapon series is the producer who pitches this to the LAPD, it's decided that these two cops are not sufficiently telegenic for the proposed reality TV show. And so they hire an expert consultant to teach them how to emote and to teach them the art of being a plausible television cop. And the person they turn to is T.J. Hooker, that is to say William Shatner. This, I think, was the film that established William Shatner, tardily, in my opinion, as a comedic go-to performer, because he played himself, and this is the first time where you really started seeing him lampoon his larger-than-life persona, the idea of him being the omnivorous egomaniac, former actor, hack actor, that sort of thing. You know, he himself recorded a CD, an album of songs, spoken word songs for the most part, thankfully, called Has Been. I mean, he's somebody who has really dined out recently, lampooning himself, playing against his own caricature, and doing so brilliantly. I mean, he won how many Emmys playing basically William Shatner as Denny Crane on Boston Legal, but I digress. Anyhow, he was brought on board in order to teach these police officers the art of being a television cop. Now, if you take a look at how that mindset translates into real life, take a look at the way modern police, contemporary police, particularly people who are members of SWAT teams and tactical teams, are dutying themselves up and kitting themselves out for the specific purpose of looking a certain way, of playing a certain role. This, of course, is just good, clean, taxpayer-subsidized fun until somebody gets killed, somebody like Iana Jones. this beautiful little 7-year-old girl who was sleeping on the sofa in the living room of her home, who was first burned by a flash bang grenade and then shot through the head in the course of a full-force SWAT raid on a duplex, one unit of which, the other unit as it happens, was housing a murder suspect who could have been taken in without violence. There were no exigent circumstances. This was not a hostage situation. This individual was not holding people at gunpoint. He could have been taken without violence. So what triggered, if you'll excuse the expression, the decision to send in a SWAT team? I contend, and many other observers have made the same argument, that the presence of an A&E camera crew on site to chronicle the exploits of the SWAT team for a cable television audience changed the dynamic of that enforcement action. Suddenly, it wasn't enough just to take the guy in. They had to have something that looked good on television. And when you have a police chief who's already shopping himself around as a potential television star, that obviously sets a corporate culture for a police department. I don't know why Mayor Bing doesn't come clean about the fact, and I think we can call it a fact, that this created a PR problem for the municipal government of Detroit of sufficient magnitude that he finally decided to fire Big Chief Sizzle Reel. The Detroit Police Department's ties to reality TV shows came under heavy criticism in May after a 7-year-old girl was shot by a police officer during a late-night raid on a home in search of a murder suspect, continues the Wall Street Journal. During the raid, which was being filmed by a TV crew, officers threw a so-called flashbang grenade into the home and entered. According to police, the officer's gun discharged unintentionally, and the bullet struck the girl, Ayanna Jones, in the head as she slept on a couch. By the way, take a look at how impersonal that description is. Take a look at how inanimate objects suddenly are volitional here when it comes to sanitizing or even exculpating the guilty parties in the death by homicide of a 7-year-old girl when the guilty parties are people wearing government-issued costumes. Now, on the other hand, if somebody had shot and killed a police officer, they would identify that person by name. They would make, in the course of the description, they would make it clear to the reader that the person who fired the gun was the guilty party, that the person who fired the gun was the actor, and that the gun and the bullet being fired through the gun were being acted upon rather than acting of their own volition. Now, of course, when the guns are in the hands of the police and the bullets being flung kill innocent people, suddenly the guns and the bullets themselves acquire this almost sentient capacity for willful action. That's just commonplace now in the statist stenography called journalism. It's amazing. The police swarm and beat an innocent civilian. We read about it being a fight. You take a look at it, it looks like a gang beating. No. This is a melee, an altercation, a scuffle. It's a tussle. It's a fight. It's not what it looks like, which of course is a bunch of armed thugs beating up some poor innocent schlep. No, this is an altercation. On the other hand, if somehow the civilian, and it's interesting how they always tell us to distinguish between police and civilians now, that's part of the martial law mindset, if the civilian somehow gets the better of the police officer, suddenly this is an assault. This is a crime. It's an act of violence. That's how the language is weighted against us. The girl was declared dead at a nearby hospital, continues the Wall Street Journal. The girl's family has filed a lawsuit against the police department alleging that video footage of the raid showed a Detroit police officer had fired at the house from outside. By the way, of course, that footage is now in the hands of the police, and they are investigating themselves as they always do. And I don't think that we're exactly overwrought with suspense now as to whether they're going to exonerate themselves. They are past masters at self-exculpation. Mr. Bing didn't address the role that incident may have played in his departure. Rather, he cited feedback internally and externally over an amount of time. Boy, could you get any more vague than that? Good grief. If he had played basketball with the same studious indifference to detail that he's displaying here, Mr. Bing wouldn't have made it to the YMCA League, much less be a Hall of Famer. It's just terrible what politics does to otherwise honest and decent people. Amid the controversy, Mr. Evans, a former Wayne County sheriff recruited to the city by Mr. Bing, was getting credit for driving change at the department, a police department that has had trouble managing records and evidence. 2 years ago, it was cited for underreporting homicides to the FBI, and its forensics lab was investigated by federal authorities, now relies on tech-heavy, data-driven approaches aimed at targeting flare-ups and crime quickly. Well, once again, that strikes me as something more that's best described as posing for the cameras rather than good old-fashioned police work. We'll talk a little bit more about that and other topics on the other side of the break. Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, so stick around.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
And we go right to the phones. Jeff from Chelsea, Massachusetts, is with us this evening. Jeff, how are you doing in the People's Republic of Taxachusetts?
Well, no, I'm doing just fine. Now, when you're talking about cops, I'm going to give you a logic trail, and you and the audience will love this, and really think about this. First off, a lot of military people are becoming police officers. And first off, before I share this, God bless our military. It's a good thing we have a military to protect this country. Now, with that said, let's think about this. Our military is training gangbangers, criminals, gangbangers, and people like that. Logically, because I believe we're lacking the warm bodies to put into Iraq and Afghanistan, and most likely Iran. So we're recruiting gangbangers. Don't be surprised if the draft comes in again.
Just for a second. I need to interject here that there was a piece in the Chicago Sun-Times just a couple of days ago talking about the fact that since 2003, since the invasion and occupation of Iraq began, there has been a meteoric increase in the number of people associated with street gangs, whether you're talking, of course, about the sort of street gangs you'd find in urban Chicago or the sort of street gangs you find in urban Los Angeles, not only in combat positions overseas, but also the fact that a lot of them come back from combat overseas, having been recruited overseas to take part in street gangs here in the United States. And that, of course, is the talent pool from which law enforcement is drawing very heavily today.
Yes. Bingo. You hit the nail right on the head. Not to mention the fact that they also become contractors like Blackwater and companies like that. But yes, you're exactly right.
Boy.
The talent pool to where police get their recruits from. And also, too, as a bonus, you look at third world countries and you see these warlords running portions of the city like some dystopian futuristic movie like The Demolition Man with Sylvester Stallone. Which gives you a movie idea of this. Basically, you have the makings of turning America into a hellhole, a third world hellhole, where you see gangbangers on pickup trucks firing 50 caliber machine guns, our gun or the Soviet equivalent, which I believe would be a combination of the two, you know, indiscriminately in the houses, going into houses and just robbing them blind. Oh, oops, a girl gets shot with a 50 caliber? Oh, well, she's a casualty. And they go inside and just strip the house bare, like some Tonton Macoot from Haiti. Oh yes, Tonton Macoot. I mean, my martial arts instructor was from Haiti, and you know, if you know a lot of Haitians from that country, you would have heard of the Tonton Macoot. They are
horrifying,
your worst nightmare. They are the military arm of the Duvalier regime, along with other regimes in that country, sort of the Gestapo of Haiti, and that's what this is going to turn into.
One of the things we're seeing right now is revenue streams start to constrict. Is that a lot of local police departments are spending a lot more time on what you could call overtime-rich activities that are directed at shaking down people rather than actual protection of life, liberty, property, that type of thing. In Ontario, Oregon, right across the Snake River from where I'm speaking this evening, over in the People's Republic of Oregon, there are a number of People's Republics that disfigure this once lovely country.
Yes.
They're having a saturation patrol for seatbelt enforcement and cell phone enforcement, things of that sort. And, of course, they're going to have the entire force of tax gatherers and revenue hogs out this evening for the purpose of shaking people down. And heaven forbid that there's an actual crime against person or property that takes place in Ontario this evening. That's one example of what I'm talking about.
Oh.
Another example is what happened in Maywood, California, where you actually had a police department that was so utterly ridden with corruption that they eventually drove the city out of business because the state insurer would not grant liability insurance to the municipal government.
Wow.
And so they ended up consolidating with Bell, and Bell, California, has been in the news this week.
Wow.
Because it turns out that their police chief was pulling down $500,000 a year, because when they hired him, they had to pay him the equivalent of what he was getting as a pension.
Oh.
And their city manager was getting $800,000 a year to manage a city of 32,000 people where the median income is like $35,000 a year.
Wow.
And so they just finally found out that this guy was pulling down the better part of $1 million a year, getting a 12% guaranteed raise each year. And finally it dawned on these people that we really can't sustain this any longer. Take a look at the tax base of a city of 32,000 people where the median income is $35,000 a year. What kind of a city government operates in that environment? I contend it's not all that different from what you'd find in Port-au-Prince or in Mogadishu.
Well, that's
and it's
it.
Going on all across the United States right now as the Depression sets in. The Depression, of course, is an economic correction. It's revealing all these things. The grand unveiling's taking place. And as the veil is lifted, we take a look at our local city governments. We're seeing that a lot of these places are run like those third world hellholes you referred to.
Well, it's going to get worse, not better. And I credit the inspiration from an article off of blacklisted.com by Doug Owen, and that article really gave me the inspiration for the thought about the recruitment of gangbangers. And you know, you just take things to their logical conclusion, and you're going to see the rape of women by police and military in this country. You're going to see the a complete ravaging of cities. You'll see cities burned to the ground again. The picture is Demolition Man with Sylvester Stallone in the beginning, multiplied that. And then to make things worse, you'll see the United Nations come in after the gangbangers do their thing, and then the United Nations take over with something even worse. And this is a pattern that's gone on in all these third world countries that Americans have no idea about. And I'm going to wrap it up with this. You're going to have predators and prey. I don't want to be the prey, and I'm not a predator.
Jeff, you mentioned martial arts. Which one are you studying, capoeira?
No. I'm not that flexible. The martial arts that I like, that I benefited from was a little bit of eczema, weapons. I took a firearms training. I took up Kenpo when I was 18 years old, jiu-jitsu. In other words,
jiu-jitsu's martial really
arts, we put the guy down really quick, really fast, and you get out of there. That's the stuff I like to study. Put him down fast.
Sure, Smith and Wesson or Glock or something like that. I'll put a guy down in a hurry.
Yeah, hand-to-hand. Before I go, the program that I benefited from the most is, in fact, Impact Model Mugging, but it has one drawback. It attracts a lot of weird people because of what it is. But it's really beneficial because it's simulated combat. You get put up against a person in a full body suit and scenario based training. And I found that was the most beneficial program of all. But if you're a traditionalist like yours truly, guess what? It could be a problem in Massachusetts because guess who it attracts? It attracts a lot of homosexuals and lesbians because they don't want to get mugged. So that's the only drawback with it. Well, I think you're on the broadcast and have a good one.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jeff. I really appreciate you calling in. Yeah, I don't want them to get mugged either. I don't want to see anybody get mugged. And so you can understand why they'd want to train. I might have some ambivalence about training with people of that sort. But then again, if they keep it to themselves, then how am I going to know? At least I don't think I'd know. Speaking as somebody who's dabbled in the martial arts, by way of recommending what I think is really practical, if you're going to be getting involved in some kind of actual hands-on martial arts, study something that involves cross-training between dirty boxing and some kind of grappling. Just good old-fashioned American folk-style wrestling, I think, is the most practical martial art you can study, both in terms of teaching you how to relate combatively to another person, wrestling being sort of a, how best to describe this, sort of full contact, full body chess, if you will, combat chess, and also in terms of just conditioning you to deal with the demands of a combative environment. Wrestling has suffered terribly because of Title IX. I don't know whether that was the specific design, but it turns out to be a very good thing for people to want to make sure that we're helpless. Every time I've been to a high school wrestling match, and I try to attend four or five of them a year as my schedule permits, I shake my head in dumbstruck wonder that we're still allowed to teach young men to wrestle. It is the American martial art. If you go back to George Washington for a really good example, when he was 47 years old, that's the equivalent of being 60 today, he wrestled and defeated 7 straight opponents at age 47. And these were soldiers. These were people in condition. He was really quite the bad dude, Mr. Washington. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number here on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back with more sedition after this. Our friend Jeff from Chelsea, Massachusetts, just called, was making some really interesting and difficult points about the military and its relationship to the police. And, of course, we are in this country, as is the case with most countries throughout history, we're taught to revere, to pray for, to support, to sustain, almost to worship the military. We have to recognize that that is a government program. Those of us who have a congenital aversion to government coercion and the plundering of our wealth have to recognize that the military, as an instrument of lethal force, is what makes all of what we don't like about government possible. I remember a conversation I had with a fellow here in Idaho who's a very active and long-time proponent of the liberty agenda, somebody who's well-known in libertarian circles and largely respected in libertarian circles for good and sound reason. He's done a lot of good. But he talked about the idea that 90% of what government does, it shouldn't do, but the 10% is really important because that includes the military and the police. And I said, well, that's the 10% that makes all the bad things possible. And this is a distinctly American perspective on the question that we're talking about here. Go back and read what James Madison had to say, and I'm going to paraphrase it as best I can from memory when he talked about the fact that of all the enemies of public liberty, war is the most to be dreaded because it encompasses and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies, and armies beget debts and taxes, and armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the subjection of the few. And then Madison went on to talk about the fact that in wartime, the executive power is aggrandized, and you have, of course, the necessary enlargement of the ranks of official sycophants and clients, and that, of course, creates a self-perpetuating apparatus of plunder, misery, and coercion until, of course, the society that sustains it is killed. So while I respect people who, out of honorable motives, enlist in the service of the military, very little of what they do can be described, in my opinion, as having anything, any colorable connection to the question of preserving our freedom. Because our freedom is not threatened from without, it's threatened from within. The largest and most potent threat against our liberties. The greatest enemy of our liberty is and always will be the government that rules us. That's Americanism 101, and that's one of the reasons why the Founding Fathers, many of whom had fought in our war for independence, the only war that really is a war for freedom, is a war against a government that is ruling a people. Bear that in mind. When war becomes a government program, it does not redound to the benefit of freedom. The only war that will ever have a positive impact on human freedom in the long run is a war against a government that is ruling you. But the men who wrote the Constitution, whatever you think of the merits of that document, these were men who had fought, many of them, or had been involved in the war for independence. And they understood that one of the reasons why it was necessary to throw off the yoke of the British government was because of the way that it had enlarged itself beyond reason and measure by fighting wars for conquest and empire. And that's one of the reasons why many of them, Madison among them, although he forgot some of what he had preached when he became president, were very critical of what we now call the military-industrial complex. Robert from Colorado has been exemplary in his patience. He's been quietly waiting while I have been wagging my gums incontinently. Robert, how are you doing?
I'm well, and you?
I'm doing reasonably well. How may it be of service to you this evening?
I just wonder if Chief Warren was listening to Phil Collins at his iPod when he found out he was unemployed. I wonder
something
if he thought
in the
it was
air
a misunderstanding.
Yeah, I almost went there this evening. I almost
Wayne
went there
County
because that's such an irresistible connection.
I'm sorry?
That's such an irresistible connection. I almost went there myself. I'm glad somebody did.
Detroit, Wayne County, Dr. Gregg, as you know, has a very interesting history. Going back to the early 1960s, someone got the bright idea of, well, why don't we take about $500 million, go in and help the community, build some houses, make it really cheap, mm-hmm. and just kind of make it so easy for people to have houses and own their own place. Well,
oh, that works so well, doesn't it?
What that did was it enriched the pockets of all the mayors and city officials who followed that time all the way through Coleman Young and beyond. And it actually ruined that city. If you ever had the occasion to see Roger and Me, Michael Moore film, it goes into the relationship between General Motors and Detroit and how they abandoned that city. And it just
I haven't seen the whole
went
thing.
Down from there.
Just by way of stating my prejudices up front, I really like some, as a matter of fact, a great deal of what Michael Moore has done.
I haven't
seen all of Roger and Me, but that's one that I definitely need to sit through and watch all the way through. I probably like it better than Bowling for Columbine. But yeah, they've made a moonscape in the middle of Michigan there. And
yes.
a lot of that has to do with so-called urban renewal and
yes.
the creation of this so-called low-income housing, affordable housing. Take a look at the dystopia that is the Cabrini Green Project in Chicago for another really good example of how
mm-hmm.
they cultivated these urban pathologies in the name of improving the community. You've got all kinds of disasters in Los Angeles and Oakland as well. And a lot of this, of course, as you point out correctly, is deeply tied, deeply implicated in this festering, squalid practice of urban corruption that has killed Detroit. Detroit is dead. If a city could walk, it would be a dead city walking. And I think that the lethal blows were probably, as you point out, inflicted way back in the 1960s. We're just playing out the string now. That's terrible.
Yeah, yeah. You said something interesting about 3 or 4 weeks ago. I forgot to ask you about it. You were talking about Henderson, Nevada, and its connection to the New World Order or something along those lines.
Military-industrial complex.
Take that and run with it. I didn't catch all what you said about Henderson.
There's a fascinating book called The Money and the Power. And if you give me a minute, I'm probably going to be able to remember. Oh, the Dentons. Sally Denton, I can't remember the name of her husband. The husband and wife team wrote it. It came out about 10 years ago. And it talks about the building of Las Vegas and Henderson. And, of course, everybody knows, or everybody should know, about Bugsy Siegel and the mob influence and the vision they had in terms of creating this oasis of vice out in the middle of the desert. But what most people don't realize is that the Federal Reserve was deeply involved in building Henderson and Las Vegas. Las Vegas, of course, is the face that they show to the world here in terms of easy access to everything that involves blowing your money on transitory ephemeral pleasures that do nothing to enlarge or ennoble the soul, which is why, of course, Mike Huckabee was doing a week from Vegas this past week. The reverend who would be president was in Las Vegas, of all the unlikely people, unlikely place. He should be in Branson rather than Vegas if he was true to his professed values. But Henderson is where a lot of the dirty deals are done. The skunk works, that is to say the black ops people who develop a lot of the high-tech stuff that's tested out at Area 51 and so forth, they have their headquarters there. There are a lot of really important nodes of the NSA and other three-letter intelligence agencies that have operational headquarters in Henderson. Pretty much everybody who lives in Henderson works for one of two industries. You either work for the organized vice industry, or you work for the military and intelligence elements of what we now call, I guess, the New World Order, the people who are involved in collating intelligence and then carrying out contract hits on behalf of the imperial overlords in Mordor in Washington, D.C. A lot of the pilotless drones that are used to carry out contract hits are operated out of Henderson, Nevada, out of the Air Force base that is located in Henderson, Nevada. And I can't explain the cheek-by-jowl relationship between the military-industrial complex and the vice industry, but it's something that the Dentons comment about. The money trail runs in such a way that they're really joined, intimately joined in that way from the very beginning. It's fascinating. I'd like to know more about it, but I haven't had time to study it in sufficient depth.
The money and the power.
Money and the power. Sally Denton is one of the authors, and then her husband was a co-author. But it's fascinating. I wouldn't have thought that a book that's just the biography of Las Vegas would be as interesting as that book proved to be. But that's just what sort of gave me entree into this subject was that book.
Exactly. Okay, well, keep up the good work. God bless.
Thanks so much. God bless you, Robert. I have a lot of friends and even some family who live in Henderson. It's a beautiful town. I think I've shared with you before the fact that when I went there with my wife and family, my wife lived in Henderson. She graduated from Henderson High School, and she hated it. She hated being in that part of Nevada when there are other places such as Elko that are so much nicer, in my opinion. But we were there for Christmas, and I love the fact that I could stand out in the front yard of the condo where we were staying in shorts with no shirt. With no shirt. I was wearing a shirt. Good heavens, I'm not indecent. With no shoes. It was 65 degrees on Christmas morning while I made my cell phone call to my parents in Oregon. I said, here we are in balmy Henderson, Nevada, where apparently it very rarely, if ever, has snowed in recorded human history. This is my idea of a good place to spend Christmas. So I sort of like Henderson, but I doubt I could live there. It's too expensive and it's too mobbed up with the worst and most lethal elements of the criminal overworld that rules us. So ends hour one of Pro Libertate, the radio program. Our call number is 866-986-6397 here on the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stick around. I'd love to hear from you at the beginning of the second hour.